It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Greece says no to the European bailout plan. Greek voters overwhelmingly rejecting a demand by the country's lenders to impose more austerity measures on them in exchange for new bailout loans for the government in Athens. With most of the votes counted from Sunday's referendum, it's more than 60% rebuffing warnings from European leaders that ignoring their calls for further austerity could force the country from the 19-nation euro currency bloc. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, who's urged a no vote, said Athens is ready to return to the negotiation table and that the public mandate will give him a stronger hand to reach a better deal with Greece's creditors. European Council President Donald Tusk called a summit of Eurozone leaders for Tuesday to discuss the situation. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says there's been progress toward a nuclear agreement with Iran. But Mr. Kerry says negotiators are still stuck on several issues.
While I completely agree with Foreign Minister Zarif that we have never been closer, at this point, this negotiation could go either way.
The foreign ministers of six nations are returning to Vienna to make a final push to secure an agreement ahead of a July 7th deadline. The United States is pledging support for Nigeria after days of insurgent attacks being blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram. In central Nigeria, late Sunday, two blasts rocked the city of Jos with an undetermined number of casualties. Earlier Sunday in Potiskum, in northeast Yobe State, a suicide bomber detonated explosives inside a Christian church, killing at least five. They cap a deadly week in Nigeria in which almost 150 people were killed. This is VOA News. U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in eastern Syria over the weekend left at least 23 Islamic State militants dead. The coalition says the airstrikes targeted structures and transit routes used by the Islamic State in and around Raqqa. Coalition spokesman says the airstrikes were intended to deny the militants the capability of moving military assets throughout Syria and into Iraq. Iraqi Sunni political leaders are accusing the government of two bloody attacks on civilians in Anbar province over the weekend. An Iraqi military spokesman is denying the charges. We get details from Edward Uranian.
Iraqi media claims two government attacks in the past 24 hours have killed a large number of civilians in Anbar province's largest cities of Ramadi and Fallujah. Sunni leaders from Anbar province say dozens of civilians were killed and wounded in a government airstrike on a football stadium near Ramadi. Witnesses also accuse government forces of shelling parts of Anbar's second largest city, Fallujah, killing several dozen people. Other reports claim the government dropped barrel bombs over parts of the city. VOA could not independently confirm the allegation. Edward Uranian, Cairo.
Saudi-led airstrikes in Yemen killed civilians in the city of Aden as a UN envoy arrived in the capital for talks on a ceasefire plan with Houthi rebels. The number of dead in the latest attacks is unclear, but media sources are reporting between 8 and 30 civilians killed. The spokesman for South Sudan's army is expressing doubt about a recent UN report accusing the army of committing atrocities. Colonel Philip Auger dismissed the report as being without merit, demanding an independent inquiry into the atrocities to determine who committed them. The report, which was based on interviews with more than 100 witnesses, accused the South Sudanese army of raping and burning women and girls alive in oil-rich Unity State between April and June. East African regional heads of state plan to meet in Tanzania's commercial capital Dar es Salaam Monday, looking for a way to resolve the crisis in Burundi. It is unclear if Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza would attend the meeting, which comes as he intensifies his campaign for re-election. Pope Francis is on an 8-day visit to Ecuador, Bolivia, and Paraguay. The Pope arrived in Ecuador's capital Quito Sunday in the first leg of his visit. He says he wants to emphasize the plight of impoverished during his trip. The United States won the Women's World Cup, beating the defending champion Japanese 5-2. U.S. team captain Carly Lloyd scored three goals to lead the Americans to victory in the title game played in Vancouver, Canada. No team had ever scored more than two goals in a Women's World Cup final. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, sitting in for the vacationing James Batty. Today is Monday, July 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan demands an independent inquiry into a UN report that accused the army of atrocities.
Our reaction to this report is that such a report must be subjected to verification, investigation.
Colonel Philip Aguirre is the spokesman for South Sudan's army. Zimbabwe's opposition parties seem to be struggling to come up with a solution to wrestle power from President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party in the 2018 national elections. And a Kenyan lawmaker warns that the country has been slow to prevent the security threat posed by the Somali-based terrorist group Al-Shabaab.
At the beginning, Kenya underestimated the threat of Al-Shabaab. To a certain extent, it also did not pay quick attention to the local conditions.
Yusuf Hassan is a Kenyan parliamentarian. Researchers inch closer towards developing a treatment and cure for dengue fever. The World Health Organization says the workforce in some African countries needs a scale-up by 140% to reach international health development targets. Those stories plus Marco Ume's sport and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The spokesman for South Sudan's army has expressed doubt about a recent United Nations report accusing the army of committing atrocities. The report, which was based on interviews with 115 witnesses, accused the South Sudan army of committing atrocities, including raping and burning women and girls alive in oil-rich Unity State between April and June. Colonel Philip Aguirre dismissed the report as without merit. He told me earlier that the army is demanding an independent inquiry into the atrocities to determine who committed them.
Our reaction to this report is that such a report must be subjected to verification, investigation. It has to be investigated whether these alleged atrocities are really true or not, because we have to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it is the SPLA soldiers that has committed these atrocities by establishing, first of all, the area of operation where the atrocities took place, so that we know which unit of the army that was operating in that area in a particular space of time. And if that is proved true, definitely the army will take measures against whoever might have committed such atrocities. We have corrupt military justice that punishes violation of rules of engagement and the rules of operation.
Colonel Aguirre, my question to you now is that, are you doubtful or reject the report of the UN, or when will the army itself begin investigating this content of this report about these atrocities that were committed?
We are doubting the truth of this report because it sounds it is politically motivated, and if it is a reality, it has to be followed by a transparent investigation that will include the United Nations mission in South Sudan, the SPLA, and other stakeholders to prove that really the army have committed such atrocities. We feel that the report came at the time when Riek Machar rejected agreement in Nairobi. And this, to us, is providing Riek Machar with tools of intransigence in which he is rejecting any agreement with the government and taking this as a moral ground that he has a case. So the coincidence between the timing of the report and the rejection of the rebels of peace agreement is really a concern.
Colonel Aguirre, are you therefore saying that perhaps the UN is supporting the rebels against the government based on this report that came out that you called suspicious coincidence?
The suspiciousness is that the report is based on people that were investigated and interviewed within the camp of the United Nations in Unity State, and more than 90% of those in the camp are supporters of Riek Machar and supporters of the rebellions. And therefore, they will never say anything good about the government or about the army. As far as they are part of the opposition, And this is why we are calling for a transparent investigation to include all the stakeholders on the ground.
Colonel Philip Agwere is spokesman for South Sudan's Army. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. A Kenyan parliamentarian is warning that much of al-Shabaab's support in the country is as a result of local groups that are disaffected and radicalized. Yusuf Hassan says Kenya underestimated the threat of al-Shabaab at the beginning and did not give attention to the local conditions that made it conducive for al-Shabaab to carry out deadly attacks. He tells VOA Somali Services' Harun Maruf that the country has just started a de-radicalization process and the result may not be felt anytime soon.
Well, I think at the beginning, Kenya underestimated the threat of al-Shabaab. And I think to a certain extent, it also did not pay quick attention to the local conditions that has made it conducive for al-Shabaab to be able to do some of the devastating attacks that it has carried out in Kenya. But now I have a feeling that the government has woken up to the crisis, to the reality, and it has taken quite a number of actions to confront this reality. One of them is having a very good and effective working relationship with the local communities that are affected by al-Shabaab, particularly in northern Kenya in the coastal regions. The second element is developing effective strategies and tactics that bring together all the Kenyan communities to confront this threat. And more importantly, I think, is the admission that, in fact, much of al-Shabaab's support in Kenya doesn't come from outside, but is as a result of local groups that are disaffected, local groups that have been radicalized, and that have found an easy partnership with al-Shabaab. And now the government has offered amnesty to young people. We are working on programs to reform and re-educate them and bring them back into the community as productive citizens.
And how effective is that program?
This is just only started now. You know, de-radicalization is a process. You know, what we have in... as far as radicalization is concerned, is a long process. It's been taking place over a period of time because of historical injustices, because of poverty, because of other disaffection, and the breakdown of the family and community structures in some of those communities. So it is a beginning. The government has realized the problem. It is working on it. And I think it is a process of which the results may not be known in a day or two, a month, or even a year. But I think, as they say in English, better late than never.
Give us some insight of how Kenya can turn around this, because it appears every other week there's a major al-Shabaab attack, high number of casualties. As you said, there are local grievances. Give us an insight of how can Kenya win this war.
I think there are two elements here. One is the operation elements, of which the Kenyan army and the Kenyan security forces are involved. In directly confronting and making sure that al-Shabaab does not cause big damage to the Kenyan population and to the Kenyan economy. And the second element, of course, which has been missing until very recently, is the community engagement, the fact that the government needs to work together, you know, because radicalization is an ideological phenomena. It is the mind set of young people.
Yusuf Hassan is a Kenyan parliamentarian. He spoke with VOA Somali Services Harun Maruf from New York. Zimbabwe's opposition parties seem to be clueless on how to wrestle power from President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party in the 2018 national elections. This following their lackluster performance in the June 10 parliamentary by-elections. As Thomas Chiripasi reports from the capital, Harare, the opposition parties are employing uncoordinated tactics in their bid to win the hearts of Zimbabweans.
Despite ignoring calls by the main opposition movement for Democratic Change Party to boycott the June 10th parliamentary by-elections for lack of democratic reforms, opposition parties like Transform Zimbabwe agreed that the electoral playing field remains tilted in favor of ZANU-PF. Transform Zimbabwe spokesperson Sungai Mazando says recent polls have taught them that more needs to be done in terms of creating a level electoral playing field ahead of any elections.
The electoral process was flawed with irregularities, which makes any statements that can be made from the figures that came out of the election a bit unfair. They need more scrutiny. I think, in actual fact, opposition parties may have performed better than the numbers that were projected by ZEC.
Masando says what is now needed is for all democratic forces to work together and stage protests to demand reforms ahead of future elections.
As opposition parties, we have tried to use the legal and justice system through the courts, and apparently nothing much has yielded. There remains another option, peaceful protests. These ones have not been tried, and we can actually put our heads together and go on the streets.
MDC Secretary General Douglas Monzora says Zimbabweans can dislodge ZANU-PF from power if they form a grand coalition.
Well, the MDC's position is that it welcomes the unity of purpose with all progressive forces. The only thing is what form that cooperation takes. But we have a big tent philosophy espoused by our president, and those who want to work with us are welcome.
MDC Renewal Team spokesperson Jacob Mafume says the engagement process must start now.
The danger in this country is the ZANU-PF led by Robert Mugabe and deputized by Emmerson Mnangagwa. All right-thinking Zimbabweans must fight to remove the hardships that these two men have caused. Once we have removed them, then we can begin talking about something else. But if we don't remove them together, we will perish.
But National Constitutional Assembly leader Love Moma Duku says there are contestations of ideas among the existing opposition figures in the country at the moment, adding that his NCA will not be party to any coalition, at least for now.
It does not make sense to be in a coalition today and you are out of it tomorrow. It's better to be together when you are in agreement on major issues. If we are not in agreement, there's no purpose of going into a coalition.
Maduku adds that the existence of several parties is important in strengthening the country's democracy.
And I think the truth be told, people have so many differences. The best thing is to accept that there are differences, and it might not work to put these people together. We are not the only country with so many opposition political parties. Other countries have solved it.
Solomon Makwati, who contested the just-ended polls as a Progressive Democrats of Zimbabwe candidate for the Kambuzuma parliamentary seat, notes that a coalition for elections has its advantages and disadvantages.
Rallying and putting all our resources together, yeah, we might come up with a better result. But on the other side also, I've seen the electorate, as it stands now, it is left faith in certain sections of other parties. It's quite a tricky one, but I agree with you, there is power in numbers.
But a member of the Zimbabwe First Party, Buka Mangunda, says political parties should work for the betterment of the country's economy.
There's a big man syndrome in our political setup, actually, it's a problem that this nation has had.
ZAPU Vice President Emilia Mkaratirwa urged all opposition leaders to immediately open dialogue for a grand coalition as the 2018 elections draw close.
Yes, as ZAPU, we have always been open to a united front, and we still feel that it is the way forward.
Political analyst Ernest Mudzengi of the Media Center says opposition parties are continuously losing elections because they do not have enough resources to mount a strong campaign against ZANU-PF, which gets the lion's share under the Political Parties Finance Act. Mudzengi believes that even if the proposed grand coalition is mooted, the United Front of Democrats will not win the polls in the absence of key reforms.
When you look at the electoral playing field being uneven, when you look at how the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is literally in the hands of ZANU-PF, even a grand coalition cannot be able to mount a challenge against ZANU-PF that can result in them winning the elections. History can prove this. In 2008, ZANU-PF lost. But what did they do? They manipulated the electoral process. We stayed for almost a month or more without election results.
Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
It's Monday morning, July 6, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Omer Sport and our Listener of the Day. Researchers are inching closer toward the development of a treatment and cure for dengue fever caused by a mosquito-borne virus that infects millions of people every year in the tropics. Investigators have found a protein or monoclonal antibody that zaps one of four types of dengue. VOA's Jessica Behrman reports.
There are four so-called serotypes of dengue fever, which infects an estimated 400 million people each year. The disease causes severe flu-like symptoms. In severe cases caused by repeated infection, the disease can be fatal. In a study published in the journal Science, researchers in the U.S. and Singapore described the discovery of a potent human antibody that neutralizes dengue type 2, an aggressive version of the virus. The monoclonal antibody was discovered in the blood of patients stricken with dengue. James Crow is director of the Vaccine Center at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee. Crow, a study co-author, says the monoclonal antibody stops infection in humans at the cellular level.
The virus injects its own genes into the cell to make more of itself, and this antibody actually staples the virus closed so that it can't do that injecting of its own genes into cells.
In experiments with mice, the human monoclonal antibody easily killed dengue serotype 2. Crow believes the discovery will lead to a drug to treat all four types of dengue fever.
We believe that it's possible to find similar antibodies for the other serotypes. So if we actually move forward for developing a therapeutic for humans, this will probably be a mixture or cocktail of four antibodies, and this would be one of the antibodies, which corresponds to one of the four viruses.
Crow says researchers are in talks with a number of drug companies interested in using the discovery to develop a cure for dengue fever. Jessica Behrman, VOA News, Washington.
When the Ebola virus hit West Africa, some healthcare systems collapsed. Attention was then focused on the shortage of health workers in countries with the poorest health indicators and the impact of those countries' ability to fight disease and provide essential life-saving interventions. For some insight into the value of training, health workers and the critical role they play, Vincent McCorry spoke with Mariatu Kagbo, president and founder of Global Health College in Alexandria, Virginia. He asked her what led her to training health workers.
I believe that what I do is it's a calling. You know, many years ago, my parents had encouraged me to take their paths, you know, one in business and one in nursing. And so I decided to satisfy both of their requirement. And so with a passion to follow the footsteps of my parents and the passion to educate others, I've been referred to as an educational student, professional student.
Yes.
So I decided that opening a college to offer the privilege of lifelong learning to so many people was imperative.
You are a native of Sierra Leone, one of those countries that were seriously affected by the Ebola epidemic. How did your observation of how things were happening and the need for health workers influence or at least make you think about what you're doing in training health workers?
Yes, absolutely. From watching from outside, it appears it was a lack of either education, in the sense that the healthcare practitioners did not know how to prevent the spread of the disease. But most importantly, the citizens in the country were not informed of the detrimental effect of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about what kind of training you're providing
okay.
in your college right in the United States.
Okay. Very several different programs, starting from a one-month program to nurse aid, you know, nursing assistant, to practical nurses and the associate degree level and the bachelor's level in nursing.
When we think about health, the health sector,
mm-hmm.
we think of doctors right up there. Every young kid wants to be a doctor. Tell us the value, okay. the role of a healthcare worker below a doctor.
Absolutely. I say to my students all the time that it is important to understand your role that you play in your patient's life. As the nurse, you are with the client 24 hours. The physician comes in about 10, 20 minutes and they leave. So absolutely, the nurses are, I believe, are the heroes of the healthcare professional.
Mm-hmm. They do quite a lot.
Absolutely.
Now, somebody might say, well, Mariatu is in Northern Virginia, or rather in America, in Virginia. What is the relevance, for instance, with people in Africa? What does your training do to help those who are in Africa?
It's amazing. Many of our students have migrated from Africa, and so the goal is for them to become educated and gain experience and return to their individual homes. Mm-hmm. So yes, educating nurses and myself, my plan is to travel to Africa and offer some of the services that I've gained over the years.
Yes, mm-hmm. And you have an opportunity to train people not only from Sierra Leone,
but nationwide. It's Global Health College.
Yes. Global Health College. And they can not work here, but also take some of the skills back home. What's your vision in very few seconds?
I want to give to people the opportunity to be self-reliant. And I believe the most powerful tool for anyone to remain, reliant on their own self is to be educated.
That was Mariatu Kagbo of Global Health College in Alexandria, Virginia. She was speaking to reporter Vincent McCory. It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sport. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with athletics. Botswana's Isaac Makwala clocked 43.72 seconds to win the 400 meters at the Resist Sprint meet in La Chaux-de-Fonds, Switzerland on Sunday. This saw Makwala reclaim the Africa record he lost less than 24 hours earlier when South African Wade van Niekerk won the one-lap race in a lifetime best of 43.96 seconds in Paris. In women's 400 meters, Nigerian Patience Okon won the race in a lifetime best of 50.76 seconds as Kabange Mupopo improved her Zambia record to 50.86 seconds. Meanwhile, South African Hendrico Branches clocked 9.97 seconds in men's 100 meters to set a South African record. In 400 meter hurdles, Tunisian Seigia Mohamed won the men's race as Nigerian Amaka Ogegbugan was second in the women's event. In France, Kenyans Eunice Sum, Silas Kiplagat and Jairus Kipchoge each triumphed with world-leading times at the IAAF Diamond League in Paris on Saturday. Sum won the women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 56.99 seconds. Kiplagat clocked 3 minutes and 30.12 seconds in men's 1500 meters, while Birech ran 7 minutes and 58.83 seconds in 3000 meters steeplechase. South African Wade van Niekerk won the 400 meters in 43.96 seconds, which was an African record for less than 24 hours. Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba set the women's 5,000 meters meet record of 14 minutes and 15.41 seconds. Turning to football, South Africa beat hosts Mauritius 2-0 in the return leg of their Orange Africa Nations Championship qualifiers on Sunday to progress to the next stage on a 5-0 aggregate. Mali beat Guinea 4-2 and Guinea dismissed Liberia 4-2 on aggregate. Early on Saturday, Ethiopia eliminated Kenya 2-0 on aggregate. Angola beat Swaziland 4-2. Senegal outplayed Gambia 4-1. Mozambique overpowered Seychelles 9-1. Burundi beat Djibouti 4-1. Zimbabwe dismissed Comoro Islands 2-0. And Uganda outclassed Tanzania 3-1 on aggregate. Although Botswana and Lesotho drew 1-1, Lesotho advanced on their away goal rule as Zambia pipped Namibia 6-5 in a post-match penalty shootout after a 3-3 tie on aggregate. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. That's it for this Monday, July 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, I'm Peter Clote in Washington saying have a nice day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the political crisis in South Sudan is taking a heavy toll on the nation's citizens. Nearly 2 million people have been displaced due to the fighting between supporters of President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Tune in on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.